from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'd like to buy the world a home and furnish it with love. Grow apple trees and honeybees and snow white turtles.
That's the iconic 1971 Coca-Cola jingle heard in homes across the country during advertising's heyday. But today's advertising business is now under existential assault, according to New Yorker media columnist Ken Auletta. His new book, Frenemies, refers to the broken friendships and truces made across an industry and near constant upheaval. Auletta joins us to discuss what this means for the future of advertising. That's all coming up after the news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Tanya Mosley, and today for Mina Kim.
Advertising is based on one thing: happiness. And you know what happiness is? Happiness is the smell of a new car. It's freedom from fear. It's a billboard on the side of the road that screams with reassurance that whatever you're doing, it's okay.
That clip is from the show Mad Men, and it captured what fueled for decades a global advertising industry, now worth $2 trillion. Today, advertising has become even more adept to curating our needs and desires. But advances in tech are threatening the very survival of the ad industry. New Yorker staff writer Ken Auletta is a longtime observer of the changes of this industry. He joins us to discuss his new book, Frenemies, and how the internet and algorithms are disrupting the advertising business and why we should care. Welcome, Ken Auletta.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Yes. Well, we heard that clip earlier from Don Draper from the show Mad Men, talking about happiness and relying on feelings and guts and instincts when coming up with ad campaigns. But you write in your new book that math men, not mad men, are the ones who are really driving and fueling this industry today. Can you explain what you mean by that?
What I mean by that is that in the days of Don Draper, which is the 60s and 70s, at an ad agency, the most powerful people, the dominant people, were the Don Draper-type creatives at the advertising agency. Today, the dominant people are the people with the data. They come from media agencies. But increasingly, the dominant people are the math men from Facebook and Google who have this wealth of data. And the advertisers all, you know, crave for that data, and they... But the assumption is that we can't just go on gut anymore, as Don Draper did, and instinct and feelings. We need math. We need science. This is science. Mm-hmm. And we need, with data, we can find out what Ken likes to buy, what Ken does with his days. And
every little detail about Ken, right?
Yeah, I mean, spooky.
Yes. You bring up the new guys on the block, Facebook and Google, and you describe in your book their scope and their impact, in part, as you said, because they hold so much power in the data that they've been able to collect. Give us an idea of the scope when it comes to advertisements and how they're able to bring in all of that power just through their data.
Well, I mean, if you're an advertiser, let's say you're McDonald's or Gillette, and increasingly you're putting your money, your advertising dollars, in digital companies like Facebook and Google. Today, digital ads have supplanted television as the most watched or the most biggest spend for advertising, and it used to be television was paramount. No longer, mm-hmm. And if you look at the growth of digital ads, it goes to two companies, Google and Facebook. 3/4 of all the ads are on those platforms.
Yeah, you're saying 6 out of 10 new digital dollars go to those guys.
Yeah, and so it's one of the reasons why some of these upstart like BuzzFeed and Vice, these digital companies have suddenly started to lay off people because they're not getting the ad dollars that Facebook and Google do. And what Facebook and Google do is they basically say, you know, if you want to know who own luxury cars and might want to buy them, either those whose leases are up fairly soon or those who have a luxury car that's three or more years older, and people who have maybe a want a second car? We can tell you all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And you can target your ads, and targeting is a big word in the ad world, at customers who, or potential customers, real potential customers. And that's a big deal because, you know, the traditional notion in advertising was that 50% of my ads are wasted and 50% work, but I don't know which is the 50%.
Right.
And they're basically, Google and Facebook are saying, we'll let you know which work, which is the 50% that works.
And what are the implications of this in the traditional sector?
Well, the implications are, there are several. From the advertiser's positive point of view, it allows them to target dollars and spend them better and increase their ability to know whether their ad worked or not, which is something that's a mystery largely today. From the consumer's point of view, what it suggests is what gave you a question, which is who gave you permission to have all this information about me?
Yeah. Right.
And I mean, for instance, I often say that one of the things that they're increasingly trying to do in advertising, they know that the public is turned off by ads, particularly on their cell phones. And 20% of Americans use an ad blocker, which block ads, right? And so they're saying, how do we get around this problem, particularly on cell phone use, which is the dominant platform or instrument? How do we change from advertising or a sales pitch to useful information to you? So, for instance, they say, can we know 2 months ago you bought a sport jacket at Barney's? You're two blocks away from Barney's. They have your GPS. They know that. And if you walk into Barney's now, we'll give you 20% off on another sport jacket. Now, the question is, do I as a consumer think, wow, that's a service for me. That's a real nice gift subscription for me. Or do I say, how the hell do you know so much about me?
Right, right.
And that's the basic question. We don't know the answer to that.
That was my next thing. We don't know the answer to it. I think up until a few weeks ago or a few months ago, people really knew that this thing was happening, but they didn't understand the mechanics of it and how it was happening, especially when it comes to those media companies like Facebook and Twitter, which know a lot about you because of the data. I'd like to know from you, though, we have always been inundated with ads. Or we felt like we have been, now more than ever. But why should we care about the peril that's happening within the advertising industry today?
You know, I started this, but I write about the media, as you mentioned in your intro. And if you think about advertising, they're the piggy bank. They fund much of the media. Newspapers, magazines, television, ad-reliant. But Facebook, 97% of their revenue comes from advertising. Almost 90% of Google's come from advertising. Most apps are funded by advertising. Much of the internet is funded by advertising. So you say if advertising dies or dramatically declines, the casualties are much broader than the advertising industry. The media industry will be decimated.
And some of those bigger guys, so the New York Times, some of the legacy organizations, are still able to survive without those advertising dollars. You mentioned in your book something about, so can you tell us that number, the percentage of advertising that they used to need in order to survive and what they're doing today?
Yeah. Well, the New York Times used to be 80% reliant on advertising and 20% on subscriptions. Today, they're about 46% reliant on advertising. The Times has an affluent readership. They can increase the price of subscribing or buying the Times at a newsstand. Most newspapers can't do that. St. Louis Post-Dispatch, Detroit News, Boston Globe, they can't do that. Mm-hmm. And that's a problem. CBS, which used to be 100% reliant, as were the other networks, increasingly they have other sources of income, so about just under 50% of their revenues from advertising. But if CBS's advertising revenue goes from 50 to 25%, or the New York Times from 46% to 25%, they're in trouble. The Times has a very small profit margin. And so advertising still is, though some institutions are less dependent on it, it is vital for their survival.
And we still haven't found another solution. So you're saying the subscription-based model is not necessarily the solution because other places that aren't the New York Times can't really sustain or expect for their reader base to subscribe, to spend money.
I would say two reasons. That's one, that people are not in Detroit, don't have the flexible income to continue to pay more. New York Times is, what, $4? Mm. You know, they can't
almost
afford
$10
that
here in the Bay Area on
it
Sundays.
Is that much? Yeah. I just bought it. No, I paid a little over $4, actually. Oh, on Sunday, yeah.
On Sunday right. Yeah.
But the other reason is that the one thing that Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump agreed on in 2016 campaign is that the middle and the working class Americans, which is the bulk of our population, their income has been frozen for 10 years. And yet their average subscriptions that they pay for monthly is roughly $260 a month, not counting gas and electricity. How the heck do they pay more, substitute for ad dollars with subscription dollars? They can't afford it.
We are talking with Ken Auletta. He's been the New Yorker's Annals of Communication columnist since 1992. He's with us to discuss his new book, Frenemies, all about how the digital age is disrupting the advertising business. Can we talk a little bit about the name of your book, Frenemies? So from my understanding, frenemies is like we work together. We may be friendly on a work basis, but I really don't like you that much. How did this come about as the name, and how is this applicable to the advertising industry?
The frenemies is I mean it as people who you work together and you partner on some things, but you compete on others. So if you look at the ad agency business, the ad agencies are suddenly surrounded by publications like the New York Times, Detroit News, NBC, who they sell their ads to. And so they're an important client for theirs. And yet, increasingly, those publications and television are creating ads, basically an ad agency inside, and disintermediating the ad agency, going directly to client. The clients increasingly are taking stuff in-house and saying, we can do it cheaper by creating our ads ourselves rather than going to an agency. Google and Facebook increasingly disintermediate them by saying, hey, going directly to clients and saying, we can help you. You don't have to go through the agency. And PR agencies increasingly becoming ad agencies. And consulting companies like Deloitte that used to be your accountant, or IBM or McKinsey that used to be your advisor or your hardware supplier, they're increasingly aggressively are buying up ad agencies. So that's one level of frenemy. The bigger level of frenemy and is the public. The public on whom you depend, the consumer, increasingly is irritated and annoyed by intrusive advertising. Think about your cell phone. You don't lend it to anyone. Mm-hmm. It's as personal as your wallet or your purse. And the thought that you are interrupting me with a 30-second ad, a pre-roll, a banner ad, and stop. It's annoying. I don't like these ads. And so the question is, how does the advertiser sell, particularly on a mobile phone? How does it reach consumers? And because they now know that the consumer is often their adversary.
How it seems that this has been the case since really the advent of the smartphone, just trying to figure out that piece of the puzzle, how you can get folks to look at ads on their phone, not be annoyed by them, not put up a blocker. Has anyone gotten closer to that? And also, yeah, answer, you shake your head, no way.
I mean, what they have to do, and they're doing in the industry, and we don't know the result yet, you have to throw things against the wall and see what sticks. So the example I gave you about Barney's, there are advertisers say, we will personalize the ads because we know information about you, and it will be a service, not an ad. We're offering you something, and that's something that they're betting may work. Mm-hmm. Will it work? We'll find out. And will it kick in privacy concerns? We'll find out.
Right. I'm talking with Ken Auletta. He has been with the New Yorker, and he is a columnist there since 1992. He has a new book, Frenemies, all about how the digital age is disrupting the advertising business. What questions do you have for Ken Auletta? Give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch with us on Twitter or Facebook with your questions. Ken, a major character in your book is Martin Sorrell. He was once called the most powerful person in advertising, and he was ousted just this spring, right, from WPP, the world's largest advertising group. He mentioned that Google and Facebook were indeed frenemies, but that Amazon was the one that kept him up at night. Can you elaborate on that?
Amazon is increasingly getting into the advertising business. And people like Sorrell like that because they want a competitor against Facebook and Google. What they don't like is the data that Amazon has. Amazon has absolute best data because they not only have your credit card and all the information about you, much more so than Google or Facebook in the following sense. When you do a search, Google knows what you're interested in, the things, the kind of questions you're asking. When you were on a Facebook page, they know who you and your friends, what you're talking about. In Amazon, they know what you've purchased.
They know what you purchased.
And yeah, that is the most valuable piece of information for an advertiser. The other reason Amazon keeps not just Martin Sorrell up at night, but clients up at night, is they're disintermediating the retail business. And you're going directly. I mean, for instance, if you ask Alexa, Amazon's Alexa, that robot in your house, or you go on Amazon, you ask for batteries, what they will offer you is the Amazon battery.
Mm.
Or if you go on Amazon and you do a search for, you want to buy something, you do a search, 50% of the people who do a search don't use Google search. They go to Amazon for it. So Google is now suddenly saying, oh, God, they can disintermediate us as well. But the clients, I mean, you think about what they're going to do. They own Whole Foods now. What are they going to do to supermarkets? They have products like batteries. What are they going to do to battery makers? Diapers they own. What are they going to do to diapers? So the businesses themselves are worried about being interrupted and disrupted by Amazon.
As well, yes. We're calling out to you if you have any questions for Ken Auletta. Give us a call at 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook at KQED Forum. And we're asking you questions. What's the type of advertising you wish would disappear? What's the one type you actually enjoy? Ken Auletta is a media columnist for The New Yorker. He's with us to discuss his new book, Frenemies, all about the digital age and disrupting the advertising business. I'd like to talk to you a little bit about many of the tech companies or the social media companies right now, in advance of the midterm elections. They are unveiling these transparency reports. They're also requiring advertisers to go through a series of confirmations to show they're real and not propaganda. But one thing that many of those folks within those companies are talking about is that they're learning just how convoluted the advertising industry is. You can't just go to one advertising agency and say, hey, here's our set of rules. They're all these little tentacles. And that's a lot of what you talk about in your book, correct?
Yeah, I mean, this is all really complicated stuff. And Facebook and to a lesser extent, Google are under the gun from the government, and the concern about privacy, the concern about fake news, the concern about their permissive policies perhaps allowed the Russians to hack into many accounts. And so they want to stand up and show that they're doing things. But in order to get compliance, there are just so many tentacles and so many different platforms. It's not easy.
What have you learned in the ways that they can do that? I mean, we're talking literally months from now, and many of them over the summer are doubling down. Google, for instance, doubling down with an August release of their transparency report.
I mean, you have to separate spin from fact. There's no question that Google and Facebook have an interest in suggesting to the world that they're doing really good, progressive things to prevent the mistakes of the past. I suspect they're spinning more than they're actually performing.
We have some calls now. We're going to take some calls from you, the listener. We have Ben in Sonoma. Ben, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Great. What's your question for Mr. Auletta?
I have a question. I'm pretty much immune to advertising. Is there any opportunity out there to pay a fee so that we don't have to advertising. I certainly pay Facebook a couple bucks a month to do that.
There is, you know, on Hulu, for instance, you can buy Hulu or on YouTube. You can actually pay extra per month to avoid not to be have ads on. This is done elsewhere. And there has been talk about Facebook doing that as well. Whether they will, I don't know. But that is a suggestion that has been made. Will people pay for to not to receive ads? I don't know whether enough people will do it to make a real difference.
This comes back to something you're saying, though, around subscriptions. And I've heard you say in the past around Facebook, what people pay for Facebook. This is another way to look at it. Would people pay to not have ads? It's still a payment system. And is it problematic in that idea that something that people are so used to getting for free that they would pay for?
Yeah. I mean, 2.2 billion people are on Facebook. Do we think many of them or a majority of them would say, I'm going to trade in instead of free, I'm going to pay? It's very dubious that that would happen.
We have another caller, Tom. Tom from Sand Hill Road is at Palo Alto. How are you?
Thank you very much for the ad. The ad, no, for this show. My question is the following. I'm with a firm that's investing in artificial intelligence and blockchain startups that are disrupting the media industry. And I'd love to know if you have any thoughts about that.
Artificial intelligence, I mean, Alexa in your home and Google Home and IBM's Watson all are reliant on artificial intelligence and ability to crunch numbers fast and target ads is also heavily reliant on artificial intelligence. There's a potential collision ahead between the advances that you make with artificial intelligence and the privacy issue, mm-hmm. because artificial intelligence allows you to climb inside people's heads in a very fundamental way. I don't mean literally climb in their head. And will people want that? Will they allow that?
And to what end? Yeah.
Well, the end of in this case, of selling more effectively advertising.
But the idea of to what end will we allow artificial intelligence to
know.
Learn? We have no idea.
We're going to find it. But we know what Europe has done. So as of May 25th, the 28 nations of Western Europe passed privacy legislation. Now, there's a history of concern about privacy in Western Europe that we don't have in the United States. But it's very hard. It really has made it very hard for people, you know, for to collect data on people's cookies.
We are with Ken Auletta. He's a media columnist for The New Yorker. He's with us to discuss his new book, Frenemies, all about how the digital age is disrupting the advertising business. We have one listener who says, stop all pharmaceutical ads, and another one who says, ban Victoria's Secret ads. Yes, we definitely hear a lot of people who say ban ads. We'll be right back right after this break. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Tanya Mosley in for Mina Kim. And we have with us in studio Ken Auletta. He's been The New Yorker's Annals of Communication columnist since 1992. And he's here talking with us about his new book, Frenemies. It's all about how the digital age is disrupting the advertising business. Ken, you've said that capitalism could not exist without marketing. And if marketing is in trouble, then the system is in trouble. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, I don't know that I would say that the system is in trouble, but I would say that capitalism in a free market where you have businesses, the businesses need to have a way to communicate to potential customers in order to get business. And that's where marketing and advertising comes in. In the former Soviet Union, you didn't have any advertising. You didn't have any private businesses. So it doesn't mean that by saying that one extols advertising and its virtues. It's just that it is a necessary communication tool to link up customer and seller.
Let's take another call. We have Suresh. She's from San Mateo. Hi, Suresh.
Hello.
Hello. What's your question?
Yeah, my question is if the author could provide very specific tips or guidelines, or even better, point to a website on what customers or consumers can do to turn off or minimize all cookies, all tracking, any ways that personal information is collected that's within our control.
Well, what's in your control is right now in the U.S., you can stop people collecting your data or your cookies if you choose to opt out. So you would go to Facebook and you would follow the procedure. I promise you, you'll probably get confused, and that's deliberate on their part. They don't want you to opt out. But you can if you go through this laborious process on Google and Facebook and others. And oftentimes people send you information and they say, will you grant us permission to acquire your cookies? And you can say no. I don't know of a particular website that deals with this, but every website or URL that comes into on your computer, you have an ability to opt out. See, what they've done in Western Europe, which the advertising community hates, is they say that the consumer in Western Europe has to choose to opt in. Mm. In the U.S., you have to choose to opt out. It's a lot easier to opt in than it is to opt out.
Right. We have someone named Steve who writes in who says, as companies rely more on technical information on demography, we see increasing amounts of forgettable, poorly crafted advertisements. I'd love to know your thoughts on this as we're now entering a stage where we used to have back in the 80s and the 70s, all of these emotionally driven or well-crafted jingles and advertisements. Perhaps Steve is saying we're not seeing those anymore.
Well, you seem to see fewer of them, and you actually do see fewer of them. Don't forget, back in the 60s and 70s, there were only three networks. The proliferation of different platforms that you could watch or listen or read was much, much fewer. And so you were much more aware of that big 30-second ad or a minute ad than you are today. Second, there's a growing feeling in the advertising community that 30-second spots are too long. They don't work. You can't do a 30-second spot, certainly on your cell phone. And so they're increasingly saying short bursts, short messages, and often messages that are more like an instant message, a marketing message rather than a creative ad. So you become much more aware that people are talking to you as opposed to, you know, impressing you with a story or a presentation.
Right.
And that's just inevitable, and there will be more of that. Then the question becomes, and the advertising people in the advertising community say this, Facebook has evidence that in video usage, the first 2 seconds determine whether you watch the full video. And that would argue that the first 2 seconds better be creative. And there are people in the advertising community who say, yeah, we got to do that. We have to be more creative. But it's not Don Draper time anymore. It's not those big 30-second or 1-minute ads and like McDonald's had, or Where's the Beef, or Children on the Hillside for Coca-Cola.
Jay writes to us. He says that the YouTube model of giving the viewer 5 seconds to decide if they want to watch or skip the pre-roll seems effective. An ad has to be pretty good to keep me from clicking skip. But when it does, I watch. That seems more like the old Don Draper method, which requires more talent. What do you think about the YouTube model? That's what he'd like to ask you.
Anything that gives the consumer more choice, I like. Yeah. And that gives the consumer more choice and control. I mean, one of the worries, though, the advertising community has, if you look at people, the data on people who use their PVR to record a show on the cable box and then watch the show, 55% of them, according to Nielsen, the measuring agency, 55% of them watch the show but don't watch the ads. They skip the ads. Now, that's alarming for the advertising community. And so when the networks say we're not losing the size of our audience, well, you're losing the size of your ad audience, and that's a big deal.
Yeah. How effective today are celebrities in advertising and really getting to the consumer? Back in the day, that was a big thing. I remember Michael Jackson and Pepsi, for instance.
That what they're finding is more influential are what's called the influencers. These are young, usually young people.
Instagram stars, folks who have a following
and,
other ways.
And they are people who seem like you and seem very natural. And they're not hawking you in a hard sell way. They seem to be enthusiastic about the products. And they're creating stories about those products. And some of them, you know, have millions of followers, which is quite extraordinary.
Let's take some more calls. We have Jim in San Francisco. Hi, Jim.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. What a great subject. And I just wanted to comment on, you know, advertisers are essentially funding the media. And in instances, for example, like cable news, where you may have a particular bias or maybe even it might be propaganda, Where is the accountability for the content, and are the advertisers responsible for, you know, holding those outlets accountable for the veracity of the information that's being broadcast?
Thank you for that, Jim. They are, aren't they?
Well, it depends. I mean, if you look at what happened to Bill O'Reilly, Bill O'Reilly, what an advertiser wants is a friendly platform for their friendly ads. If the platform becomes unfriendly, the accusations against Bill O'Reilly for sexual harassment made an unfriendly platform, and they pulled out, and ultimately it got him fired.
And you're talking about Bill O'Reilly from Fox News.
Fox News,
and,
yeah.
All of the instances that were happening with him and sexual harassment.
Yeah, and also, you know, you have it with Samantha Bee. She uses a curse word, a vulgar word, and she lost a couple advertisers. She's not losing her job. You had Laura Ingraham said some incendiary things. She lost some advertisers, didn't lose her job. But advertisers have a say. But do you want advertisers basically to screen content? I think that raises all kinds of other questions, because what they're going to say is we don't want anything that's too controversial.
Yeah.
And because it's not safe.
Right.
And that would homogenize too much.
Yeah. We saw that with Super Bowl many, many years ago with Janet Jackson, right? So with the advertisers saying that we're going to pull out, and there being lots of folks from the public saying we won't watch.
Well, you also did it in the 60s and 70s. Advertisers that would veto black actors.
Mm-hmm.
It's not for our friendly, you know, our friendly product.
That's right.
So you don't want that, and you don't want them to have that kind of power.
We have a lot of people who want to talk with you. Let's take another caller here. We have Kathy in San Francisco. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, I just want to say real quick that the ads that I dislike the most are Netflix violent movies aimed at teenagers. For example, showing walkers, a guy getting beat up in a hallway surrounded by walkers, teenager, by another teenager. It's the worst thing for America. We don't need any movies like that.
Thank you very much, Kathy. So she's talking specifically to the platforms where they have their ads for the movies that they have on those platforms. Thank you so much for that.
Yeah, I don't have anything to add to that. I mean, the violence is something that travels very well. There's a story about China today, and that's what they want. They want violent shows. It's a huge growing market for American television and movie theaters. And increasingly, those are the blockbuster movies that sell internationally. They're not movies that, personally, I want to go see.
We have another call, Les from Cupertino. Hi, Les.
Hi, I have a question about pricing. Instead of today, people basically get the same price for the same item. Will companies use information about you to charge more to customers who are willing to pay more?
Thank you for that call, Les.
I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I think clearly they'll use information about you to charge you less. Why would they use information about you to charge you more? That would be a turnoff, I would think.
Right, right. I think maybe the idea of because you might be a premium, paying a premium based on who you want, I'm not certain. But yes.
If I find out, if I'm a premium customer and I find out that they're charging me more, they're discriminating against me because I'm a little more affluent.
Right.
I don't think I'd be very happy.
We're talking with Ken Auletta. He is a media columnist for The New Yorker. He's here with us to discuss his new book, Frenemies, all about how the digital age is disrupting the advertising business. We have a couple more comments. Nate says, unless we control our feed, they control our lives. He's basically saying that basically algorithms and unless we figure out how to control our feed, yes, it's controlling our lives. That's what another caller said to you a couple of calls ago, just wanting to know how to even stop that from happening.
Yeah, the privacy issue could become a very significant issue in this country and one that threatens the data collectors at places like Google and Facebook and Amazon, or not. Mm-hmm. But we're going to find out. We can't know the answer yet.
You write in your book that reaching Generation Z requires a different approach to advertising. First off, give us a sense of what is Generation Z and how so?
Generation Z are teenagers, basically, and millennials are the generation in their 20s just above them. Facebook has a heavy concentration of millennial users. Snapchat has a heavy concentration of younger or Generation Z. Evan Spiegel, I quote in the book, he's the founder of Snapchat. He believes that Generation Z is more concerned about privacy than are millennials. And therefore, they are turned off by heavy data collection. And there's some study evidence, which I report on in the book, to attest to that. Will that continue? What happens when people offer Generation Z a bargain or a trade, you know, a reduced price in exchange for your data? We'll find out.
The other side of that, though, with Generation Z and then what's after Z?
That's it. Z is Z.
What will we start calling the kids after Generation Z?
We'll say Z, Generation Z wannabes.
Right, right. But the other side of that might be that they're used to this landscape and they're very savvy in it. And so they're working in this space as we adapt it to television ads and newspaper ads before then. What do you say to that idea that this might be a landscape that they may be more comfortable with?
Well, certainly that has been the view of Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook for many, many years, that they are less concerned about privacy and more concerned with communication and having communities of interest, talking and sharing. Sharing has always been a big word at Facebook. And remember how alarmed some parents became because they said, wait, what is my daughter or son sharing on Facebook? And will it come back to haunt him when he seeks a job when he's out of school? But there's no question that there is there are generation divides here between those who are younger who are less concerned about privacy and those who are adults who are more concerned.
Let's take another call. Andres from San Francisco. Hi, Andres.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Ken mentioned earlier that capitalism is kind of the engine of society, and I would say that even advertising is kind of the fuel for that. So I don't understand why ads are so vilified when they basically enable Google, Twitter, Facebook, all these companies to provide free services in exchange for better advertising. Which do we really want to go back to a world where advertising is just generic and it doesn't 90% of it doesn't even apply to you or you're interested in?
Thank you for that, Andres. So basically, he's saying why are we maybe as a society collectively vilifying the advertising industry when they are the fuel for capitalism?
Well, if you have an annoying ad, you may support private enterprise and small business and stuff like that, but that doesn't mean you have to support the ads that they produce that feel manipulative, that feel stupid, that feel interruptive. People are not, you have to separate the two. And if your message is a bad message or an annoying message, I don't care whether your public doesn't care whether you're trying to match the seller and the buyer, the public really will say, and they should say, do a better ad.
It's been that way since the beginning of time, though, right? I mean, even from the beginnings of television, the commercials were a chance to go get a snack or get something done. You know, it's always advertising is seen as a necessary evil, but just a part of the landscape. But more and more, we're able to just bypass it.
But you couldn't, you know, in the early days of television, you didn't have remote control. You couldn't click the ad. You could go out of the room, but you didn't click. And you watched the ads. And oftentimes the shows, you didn't have ads. You had, this was brought, Colgate-Palmolive Hour. It brought to you the whole hour by a sponsor. So it took different forms. But when once you start getting the clicker and once you have your other devices, your iPad, your iPhone in your lap and the ability to click or your PVR ability to skip, it changed the game in a major, major way.
Here's something I always wanted to know. I heard rumors that in the beginning, say with radio and then the early days of television, that news was actually created so that advertising could exist. Is that true? That it was the other way around at some point?
No, I don't think it's true. There was no question that, I mean, I remember John Cameron Swayze, who was an anchor, smoking a Camel on,
yes,
on the set. I mean, I wasn't there, but I've seen clips of it, which is quite extraordinary. Edward R. Murrow smoking on CBS. But news was in part, it was only 15 minutes, the nightly newscast, but in part it was to show that, I mean, back in those days, the networks were regulated more heavily by the government, and they were trying to show the government that they were good citizens, they were doing good work. In addition, Children's Hour, yeah, you know, children's program on Saturday morning, not having certain kinds of programs in the evening until a start time of later when the kids were presumably asleep. So the government was, the networks and the radio was very concerned about government breathing down their back.
We have someone, Marcia, who writes, I'd like a dark sky at night. I don't want to be exposed to secondhand smoke. I don't want drones flying overhead. And I haven't used commercial media since Four Arguments Against Television was published. Is there any hope for me?
I mean, read books.
Read books, yes. I'm talking with Ken Auletta. He's been the New Yorker's Annals of Communication columnist since 1992, and his new book, Frenemies, all about how the digital age is disrupting the advertising business, is now out. I'd love to know from you, is television advertising as valuable as it used to be? Folks spending millions and millions of dollars to have a 30-second spot.
Probably not as valuable as it once was, in part because people have technology has allowed them the tools to skip those ads or ignore the ads.
But television still is big business. It's the number one place where people do consume, even though they've been disrupted by digital, correct?
Oh, no. Television's big time. And what different is, I mean, back in the 70s and early 80s, the average 90% of Americans at night watch one of three networks, ABC, CBS, or NBC. Now it's down in the 30s because you have a proliferation of other networks and channels and the internet. So there is a feeling that the ads are not as big, not as effective. For instance, it's very hard to think, as I sit here, of a single product that has been introduced with a 30-second ad in the last number of years. They don't do that. They do it. They introduce the products of social networks and different ways, and because that's based on the assumption that those ads are not going to be as effective as they once were.
Let's take another call. We have with us Ned from Oakland. Hi, Ned.
Hi, I was just calling. So it's been acknowledged that our data has value, and I was just wondering if anyone is exploring any compensation for the individuals who are supplying this data. Like, if I'm the cow, can I get a cut of what the farmer's being paid?
There is, as we, the earlier caller talked about that. There is, I don't know whether it's, I would say it's a growing chorus, but there are a number of people who are making that proposition that, that people should be paid for their data, as people like the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal are claiming that Facebook, for the use of their news stories, should compensate them. And the way cable compensates television stations or networks for the use of their programs. And that's that will rise in the future, that, that clamor. And whether it's fulfilled, I don't know. But, I mean, clearly Facebook and Google don't want to do that. On the other hand, will they be compelled to at some point?
Let's take another call. We have John. Hi, John. John from Arinda. How are you?
Good.
Arinda, I apologize.
Yeah, I have two quick points. Is data anonymized? Zuckerberg says it is, but when you sign up, you give them your name and address. And secondly, Steve Jobs says people don't know what they want. Said people don't know what they want until you show it to them. That's quite different from using data, which is really just a record of the history of people, not an inspired guess for a new product.
No question. That's right. The data is anonymized. When Facebook shares data or Google shares data with advertisers, they don't share your name, but they share your IP address. So they know who you are. They know where you live, and they have a tremendous amount of data about you. On the point of Steve Jobs, a very cute observation, which is true. I mean, I think back some years ago, I wrote a book about network television called Three Blind Mice, and I remember looking at the Bill Cosby show. Bill Cosby show came on the air in 1984. There were no comedies on television at the time it came on, and the survey research for that show when they did research on the pilot for The Cosby Show, was one of the lowest ranking surveys in history.
Really?
And it predicted this will not be a hit. It will not do well. And Brandon Tartikoff, who was the head of programming, Grant Tinker, who was the head of the network, said, we think it's funny. Let's put it on. And it became one of the greatest hits of all time on television. So they went with their gut. And not with the data, and that's Steve Jobs brilliant about this stuff. He understood that you know the iPhone would change things.
What were some surprises you learned in researching this book? You've been studying the media landscape for so long, but stepping into this advertising space.
Well, I learned even more acutely than when I began with the assumption that this would be true, how dependent on advertising the media is, and how we have a stake in the media in whether advertising revenues continue to flow. I learned how disrupted the advertising agencies are. I learned that marketing dollars are defined as public relations, lobbying, direct mail, coupons, shelf space ads, etc. That's the biggest spend. In the up to $2 trillion that is spent on advertising and marketing, only a quarter of that is spent on advertising. Three quarters of it is spent on marketing. And marketing is in some messaging and all that
stuff.
All
of those other, yeah.
And I didn't realize that. So that's one of the reasons why I talk about marketing as well as advertising.
We have a few other thoughts. Bruce says, internet and social media ads are mostly ignored via banner blindness. We are in a crisis when Google and Facebook and not an independent third party are telling advertisers how effective their ads are. You've probably heard this quite a bit from folks very much concerned about this.
Yeah, but the advertiser, the clients who are spending the money on Google and Facebook, they want the data. They don't just want to take Google and Facebook's word for it. They want to see the actual data of results. And that leads to the kind of loggerhead sometimes about that, because Google and Facebook don't want to share. It's an advantage they have. They don't want to share too much of their data and the results, and yet the advertiser wants them to share more. But the advertiser doesn't just say, "All right, Facebook says this is a success." I mean, they don't. They're a business, and they're looking for data too.
They're a business. You talk about the crisis for the media industry. But one of the things that we've seen is that sports has done a great job of offering premium packages and having a robust advertising revenue stream. What can we learn from that? Or is there anything to learn from that? Is that just a different entity in itself?
Well, it's actually sports has some difficulties now. I mean, you look at ESPN, which has been the dominant sports network, and it's come to light that they've overpaid for sports rights, and they're not making the kind of money they were making, and that puts pressure on Disney, their corporate parent. So there's a growing argument that the networks will not be able to afford sports rights in the future, and those with deep pockets like Facebook and Google and Amazon and Apple will, and Netflix, and that's one of the tensions in the business today.
I'm so happy that we have had you here. Ken Auletta, he is the New Yorker's Annals of Communication columnist, and he has a new book out called Frenemies, all about how the digital age is disrupting the advertising business. Thank you so much for being here and answering our calls.
It's been my pleasure.
We'll be right back.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of the Minetti Schremm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.